Hello again. This is Carol Bond returning with the Decatur Herald Review, dated November 24th, 2015. We'll begin this segment of our broadcast, our reading, with the obituaries. Judith A. Judy Jones, 80, of Decatur, passed away Saturday, November 21st, 2015, in McKinley Court. A private family graveside service will be held in Graceland Cemetery. Beverly K. Andreese, 81, of Assumption, died November 21st in her home. Memorial service will be 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, November 25th, in Memorial Presbyterian Church of Assumption. Burial will be in Pleasant View Cemetery, Assumption, Illinois. Memorials may be made to St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital or Wounded Warrior Project. William E. Jean Parrott, 82, of Arthur, passed away at 5:30 a.m. on Sunday, November 22nd, at the Arthur home. Visitation will be held from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Friday, November 27th, at the Edwards Funeral Home, 221 East Main in Arcola. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, November 28th, at the First Baptist Church, 120 East Park Street in Arthur, Illinois. Reverend John Stewart will officiate. Burial with military rites conducted by the Arthur American Legion Post 479 will be in the Arthur Cemetery. Memorials may be made to the First Baptist Church of Arthur or the Arthur Volunteer Fire Department. We turn now to another article of local interest concerning education, and the headline is The Garney Trio Charms Enterprise Students, and this was written by Valerie Wells. When the Garney Trio's Tina Nicholson asked students at Enterprise School if they liked dance music, she got a rousing affirmative response. The students probably didn't expect the kind of dance music Nicholson was talking about. The next number was a tango. Nicholson on oboe, Claire Taylor on bassoon, and Laurie Glencross on flute all teach at Millikan University and play in the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra. As an outreach sponsored by the Millikan Decatur Symphony Guild, small groups like theirs visit schools to give performances and talk about their instruments to encourage children to try band. The group also has a website, garneytrio.com. Our instruments have been around for 400 years, Nicholson said. Of course, they've had modern updates. The flute, for example, Glencross said, used to be made of wood, which is the reason that flute is classified as a woodwind. But as pretty as the wooden flutes sounded, they couldn't get loud enough to compete in an orchestra, so they began to be made of metal. Hers is gold with silver keys. Each woman played a short solo, highlighting her instrument's unique sound. Glencross played a portion of Syrinx, S-Y-R-I-N-X, by Claude Debussy, written for solo flute, and highlighting its birdsong qualities. Nicholson played the Snake Charmer song, which is known by many titles. There must not be any snakes in here, she said when she finished. Taylor, whose first instrument was clarinet as a child, took up bassoon when she grew big enough to handle its size and weight, and showed the children how it can play a bass line or high notes or even a jazz solo. The Symphony Guild's Larry Wade, who was on hand to introduce the trio, said the Guild is responsible for 251 loaner instruments donated to the Guild and refurbished. Almost all of them are on loan to kids and school bands and orchestras. The Guild also provides scholarships to young musicians who show promise and pay for years' lessons at Millikan. If they are exceptional, they can get a second year of lessons. The Guild also sponsors the Decatur Youth Symphony Orchestra. Cheyenne Barger and Blake O'Loughlin, both fourth graders, are learning to play recorders in music class. Neither realized they would be hearing professionals play. They thought it would be other kids. I liked the bassoon, because it sounded so cool, Cheyenne said. We turn now to the opinions page. This is an article, it's an editorial under the column Our Views, and the headline is Reducing Government is Serious Business. Illinois taxpayers could save significant dollars by reducing the number of units of government. However, Democrats and labor unions need to take the effort seriously first. Twice, pranksters interrupted a task force meeting last week on the subject. At one point, during a vote on whether to make collective bargaining permissible, instead of mandatory, the song Solidarity Forever was played over a conference call phone. During a discussion about eliminating a state mandate concerning staffing of fire departments, one of the pranksters played a fire siren on the conference call. How cute. What's next? Wedgies? TPing the governor's mansion? Illinois has more than 7,000 units of local government. One way to save taxpayer dollars is to reduce those levels of government. Most of that reduction will come by doing away with redundancy, overlap, and duplicate administrative costs. Some of the committee votes, especially the one on collective bargaining, are arguably in the wrong forum. However, for taxpayers struggling under ever-increasing property tax bills, the issue isn't funny. Many taxpayers and companies are voting with their feet and leaving the state. The state's number of governmental units is first in the nation by far. It includes more than 3,200 special districts, which include such governmental units as drainage districts, park districts, library districts, and fire protection districts. To add to taxpayer injury, that state has mandated many activities that add costs to these local units. While each of these units will argue that they are necessary, an Illinois tax bill could be used as an example of being nickel and dimed into oblivion. The overall system is so confusing that experts disagree on just how many units of local government are in the state. There is little or no oversight on many of these governmental units, and the system is so complicated and vast that taxpayers cannot keep track. Unfortunately, Democrats in the General Assembly have boycotted some of the task force's meetings. Only one Democrat attended last week's meeting, chaired by Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti. There's some more maturity on display. The Democrats seem to be taking every opportunity to embarrass Governor Bruce Rauner, even when the issues are real ones that affect taxpayers. If Democrats cared about taxpayers, they would show up at the meetings and participate. The current mass of local governmental units is unsustainable and places a burden on taxpayers to maintain a system that has outlived its usefulness. Streamlining government is one way that Illinois can return to being competitive on the national and world stage. Pranks and skipping meetings will not accomplish that goal. Turning to other columnists, we'll find out what people are writing to Dear Abby or Jean Phillips. The first letter reads like this. Dear Abby, I'm 23 years old and currently in the county jail. I'm gay and also an addict, having battled a heroin addiction for the past 5 years. I managed to stay clean for almost 2 years. During that time, I enrolled in college, got engaged, regained the respect of my family, and started to have a normal life. Things were going very well for me, and then I relapsed. I threw everything away. Abby, I need to know why. When things go well for me, I feel as if I don't deserve to be happy, so I self-destruct. I have absolutely no self-confidence. I'm very unhappy. Even when I seem to get what I want, it turns out to be not exactly what I wanted in the end. How can I fix this? I really do want to be happy. I just don't know how. And the letter is signed, Unhappy Man, in Indiana, Pennsylvania. Here's her answer. Dear Unhappy, your arrest may have been a blessing in disguise. It has given you time to think clearly about why you are in this situation. Because you now recognize what your issues are, you have already started on a path to healing. You say you dislike yourself and your self-esteem is very low. This may be the reason you sabotage yourself when things start going well for you. After your release, a licensed psychotherapist can help you find the answers you're looking for. Your nearest LGBT community center would be a good place to start. Because you slipped up once doesn't mean you will do it again. So stop beating yourself up and try to think positive. I wish you luck and a successful future. The next letter is this one. Dear Abby, I met Gil a year ago. He was one of the nicest men I'd ever met. At the time, I didn't realize he was a mama's boy. But after we started to talk, I noticed he would repeat everything to his mother. We discussed it, and it stopped. But that's when his mom started treating me differently. I'm pretty sure he told her what I had said. Gil loves my cooking and has told me I cook like she does. I don't know if that's so good. I really like him, but I don't know if I can handle his being such a mama's boy. If he could cut out the apron strings, we could have a great relationship. He treats me like a queen, he respects me, never says an unkind word, and compliments me often. But if I plan a meal for him, and then his mom decides she wants him at her house, he cancels on me because he doesn't want to hurt her feelings. Gil is 51 and hasn't been in a serious relationship in several years. I'm falling in love with him and don't want to lose him. What do I do and how do I handle this? And the letter is signed, Coming in Second in Missouri. Dear Coming in Second, your mistake is trying to compete with Gil's mother because you can't win. The woman who snags Gil will have to accept that they are a package deal. Not many women these days are willing to accept that, which may be why Gil hasn't had a serious relationship in years. However, if you are the exception, the way to handle this would be to cultivate and ingratiate yourself with his mother. Find out what her favorite flowers are and send them with a sweet note. Invite her to join you and Gil for dinner and movies. If she offers suggestions about your cooking, accept them gracefully. I wish you luck. We'll take a look at Mary Hunt's column. Today's headline is Save Big at Warehouse Clubs. It's been several years now since my husband and I first began talking about relocating to another state. At first, it was only a dream, but soon idle chatter turned into serious talk. That developed into a list of must-haves, things a new location would have to offer for us to even consider making the leap. What was at the top of the list? Weather. Having lived in Southern California for most of our lives, we knew it would be impossible to beat the weather we'd come to love and had pretty much taken for granted. But finding the next best weather was at the top of our must-haves. Next on the list, Costco. You think I'm kidding? They don't call me the Queen of Costco for nothing. I believe that anyone, a household of one or a household of many, can stretch the dollars by shopping at a discount warehouse club, such as Costco, but only if you're willing to stick to a very strict list of rules, some of which will be unique for your particular situation. And here's a list of her rules. The first is shop with cash. Having the complete contents of your checking account, overdraft protection plan, and credit card limit available in the form of your checkbook or credit card could easily enable you to pop one of those big screen TVs into your cart. Go with cash only and you'll avoid lots of temptation. Shop with a list. Decide what you need before you get there. If it's not on the list, don't buy it. If that 55-gallon drum of shampoo turns out to be a true need that you simply forgot to put on the list, you can always return to buy it later. Justify the membership fee. At $25 to $35 a year, just for the privilege of membership, make sure you will realize a net savings in excess of the fee. Don't outshop your storage space and ability to reasonably consume. If anything will nullify your best intentions, this will be it. No matter how great the bargain, how terrific the deal, if you can't reasonably use a 50-pound bag of flour or 25 pounds of onions before they spoil, that was no deal at all. Never buy more than you are sure, not hope, think, or feel, but sure that you can use without creating a false need. Create an appearance of scarcity. Once you get home with cases of this and that, even paper towels or toilet tissues, you'd best find a place to stash your supply or it will disappear faster than Colorado snow on a bright sunny day. Remember this, out of sight, out of mind. Divide and conquer. Costco is notorious for its prepared entrees. They're made in-store, ready to be baked or finished off at home to serve up to 10. I buy those entrees routinely because they are fabulous and I cannot make them myself for anywhere close to Costco's price, and mine is a household of two. Here's what I do. The minute I walk in the door, I take the time to divide these big entrees into servings for two, transferring them to my vast collection of Snapware containers, equal to or even better than Tupperware, but much cheaper. Sometimes I freeze the reportioned servings, but most often simply put them into the refrigerator. Recently, I bought a container of ravioli lasagna with beef and pork bolognese sauce for $15.49. That's $4.49 a pound at Costco. I divided it into 5 2-serving portions. That works out to about $1.55 per serving. I could have just as easily reportioned this into single servings, perfect for lunch or dinner. Last, I snap a picture of the product label so I'll know what I bought and how to prepare it. And her final piece of advice is this: shopping buddy. Worried that even with all of these techniques, you cannot justify warehouse club-size quantities? Find a friend or neighbor who's in the same situation so you can split your purchases. You can split a membership unless you are in the same household, but you can split the fee. Then one of you can be the designated shopper. You will benefit from the high quality and low prices you'll discover at warehouse clubs like Costco, Sam's Club, and BJ's. Here's an interesting article on page 8. The headline is Bayer Promoting Bee Health, and the dateline is Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. It's an Associated Press article. In a Nordic-inspired building tucked in a corner of the Bayer Crop Science North American headquarters, high school students wander through 6,000 square feet dedicated entirely to the specialness of bees. Children taste different types of honey and examine the differences between honeybee and carpenter bee specimens. The pesticide maker highlights its work to foster the insects around the world, welcoming school-age children at the site built apart from plant research labs and executive offices. Amid the displays are bottles of Bayer pesticides, something that struck Carol Garrison, a student at Raleigh's St. Thomas More Academy. That struck her as odd. I thought it was a little weird to see some of that among all the bee-related things, Garrison said. It was like, is that supposed to be there? That display in that building captures Bayer's multi-billion-dollar balancing act. Some of those pesticides contain tobacco-derived chemicals called neonicotinoids that many researchers say play a role in declining bee populations. Bayer spent $12 million last year when it earned profits of more than $3.6 billion promoting bee health as the world's top neonic maker and number 2 Syngenta fend off suggestions the chemicals are bee killers. Both companies are fighting pressure from regulators in the U.S. and Europe with publicity campaigns and lobbying aimed at telling people that neonics are beneficial and safe when used correctly, and that bees face greater perils from parasites, pathogens, and poor diets as wildflowering plants diminish. Bee die-offs could disrupt the human food chain, with a third of the foods consumed by Americans and Europeans dependent on pollinators like them. Researchers suspect neonic pesticides play some role in reported die-offs and the mysterious colony collapse disorder, but they don't know how much. A comparison of more than 3 dozen pesticides found neonics produced by Bayer Crop Science and Syngenta among the chemicals most toxic to bees, according to a September study by USDA researchers. Bayer, Syngenta, and Monsanto, which coats its seeds with neonics, are encouraging nonprofits, landowners, and governments to plant more flowers and other plants that bees need to feed. We'll take a brief look at the Decatur Tribune. Paul Osborne editor. His City Beat column has this article: Councilman Faber buys space for column explaining views on issues. And there's a photograph of Councilman Bill Faber. Decatur City Councilman Bill Faber is buying ad space in today's print edition of the Decatur Tribune, that would be on page 7, to explain his feelings on the issues. Faber will be running his paid column every other week for the next 3 months. This week, his column is about a dangerous precedent he believes the City Council has set in its recent appointments of high-level city staff members to the Library Board and to the Civic Center Board. I have not agreed with Councilman Faber on some of his stands since he was elected to council earlier this year, but the appointment of city staff members to be voting members of such bodies as the Library Board is a credible issue. I could easily debate both sides of this issue, but it does seem a little awkward to me to have, for instance, Greg Zantara, treasurer of the City of Decatur, as a trustee on the Library Board, which goes into closed session to discuss such things as how to respond to Mayor Julie Moore Wolfe's letter asking for the title to the library, or later on, setting price or terms for the City of Decatur to buy the library building. Should a city staff member with direct ties to the city manager be party to those private discussions, or possibly be the vote that decides which way and at what cost the Library Board will move? The next segment of his column is just titled, Ouch. City Manager Tim Gleason's three proposed revenue enhancements took a beating at Monday night's City Council meeting. The Council Chamber was overflowing with a crowd that arrived to protest the proposed 5-cent gas tax, huge increase in liquor license fees, and creation of a video gaming license, and an associated $750 per machine fee. The council rejected the increase in liquor fee license fees and tabled the gas tax and gaming license votes. I think that if the two tabled proposals pass at a future council meeting, and I'm sorry, but the rest of that sentence has been deleted by an editorial error. Evidently, it is the writer's opinion about whether or not these items will pass or not pass when they are proposed again. This has been Carol Bond with the November 24th issue of the Decatur Herald and Review. I look forward to reading with you again.